Turn back on the record, Mr. Schneider.
Thank you. So, Mr. Phillips, I believe we were talking about the elevated structure, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think you had just said that the structure as set forth in Mr. Bishop's documents does comply with the ADA?
I said that. I'm not sure I completely agree with that.
Well, so my question to you again then is, if it doesn't comply with the ADA, what is the regulation in the ADA that you think it doesn't comply with?
Unfortunately, ADA is not always very specific. It is up for interpretation. And that interpretation could be made that a span of, I think this was referred to as 2,200 feet long or something like that, a half a mile, might be ruled to be inaccessible for, say, the midway point, and that ADA regulations could, in fact, require midway connection points so that it is meeting the requirement of access for all.
Okay, so you don't...
I was going to say, that it's just not that specific in the ADA manuals, but it is rulings that we have understood in other projects that have occurred.
Well, but my understanding is you testified that one of the reasons it wasn't considered is that it wouldn't meet the ADA. Are you now saying that you don't know one way or the other whether it would meet the ADA?
I think it's fair to say it's up for interpretation, yes.
In just a moment, Mr. Schneider. If we're not using that illustrative item, we'll take that down.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider.
So, Mr. Phillips, when you did the auto turn at the intersection of 24th Avenue Northwest and Park Street, and you didn't show the aprons, did you have to take a step to remove the aprons from the CAD files that you used for the auto turn?
I don't recall the when those were the background of that was generated in relation. It's possible, but I don't recall.
So you testified that that, in your opinion, the, well, let's go back to the warning zone. So are you responsible for the depiction of the warning zone in the EIS? Or was that done by someone else?
That was prepared with some of my input, yes.
Okay, and so how is the size of a warning zone determined? Or how will it be determined? Is there anything in the EIS that tells us that?
No, there's nothing that says the dimensions of it.
And so in the area along Shilshoal where you have driveway after driveway and warning zone, presumably warning zone after warning zone, is it your opinion that those warning zones are going to be effective in such a location? And if so, what's that opinion based on?
The warning zone is prior to where you are going to be crossing that conflict zone. And just because there's one after another doesn't mean that the advance warning wasn't given.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last sentence.
Just because there's one driveway after another doesn't mean that the warning wasn't given. It was given in advance of those driveways.
Right, but my question is what was the basis for your testimony that giving these warnings would be effective, particularly in a location where there's one after another and along Shilshoal? I'm compounding the question, and I apologize, but let me step back and start over. Along Shilshoal, one of the directions is downhill, correct?
At the west end, yes.
Well, isn't all the way from Market Street where the Shilshoal turns and heads more directly to the east, isn't that all downhill?
Yes.
And do you know anything about the speeds that bicycles attain on that downhill stretch?
They're going to be potentially have faster speeds there.
Okay. And if there's driveway after driveway and warning zone after warning zone, is the expectation that the bicyclists are going to slow down for every warning zone?
Those warning zones have nothing to do with the grade that you were talking about. So when they're flat, they're going to see those warning zones and understand the green paint associated with the conflict zone and understand that there's a condition there they need to be worried about.
Okay, and so you're designing in the expectation that the bicyclists will pay attention to and respond to the warning zones, correct?
With lots of green paint and highly visible markers out there, I think it is going to be pretty clear they need to be aware of their condition.
And my question is, you're designing in the expectations that the bicycles will respond in an appropriate manner to those warning zones.
I think that's reasonable to assume.
And what is that assumption of reasonable bicycle behavior based on? Can you identify any studies that confirm that bicyclists respond to warning signs or traffic control signs of any sort?
The NACTO guidelines suggest that it is a best practice.
Okay. And don't the NACTO guidelines also say you shouldn't put two-way side paths in places where there are lots of conflicts?
It may say that it is, there are other, other things that you could consider.
That's all I have.
Anything further?
Just a couple of short questions. Can you describe the warning zone? We sort of added that in the questions from Mr. Schneider. So what is that concept generally in your understanding? How is it described in the EIS and what's its purpose?
I may flip to the EIS.
Of course. This is, you're looking at the EIS itself?
EIS.
That's all one.
Okay. So there's a note on the upper left corner that says driveway crossing warning zone, and it's implied in this graphic, given the location of the green lines starting from the truck wheels, that's the swept path and is an area similar to what's been referred to as the incursion zone.
Okay. There was some discussion about the elevated trail structure. Putting aside ADA for a second, does the design that's depicted in the drawings prepared by the coalition's expert achieve the project objective, in your opinion?
No, it doesn't.
And why?
There's a lot of uses and streets connecting where somebody may be living in that portion of Ballard coming down those side streets that would want to enter onto the trail.
Okay. And to accommodate that, what would you need to do from a design standpoint?
As I was just testifying, it may be that elevators would be required, but at a minimum, the street below on Chilshol would have to also be improved to move people to the ends of this trail design.
And is that included in the design that you've review from the coalition's expert?
The design is shown in their drawings, but it's not included in the costs.
Okay. What I meant was the elevator.
The midway elevators are not shown.
Okay. I have no further questions.
Just very briefly.
Let me pause and ask you a question. I have some questions. I was going to do those. I think we were going to try to do those at the end of your first round so that you would have the benefit of having me ask questions and you can go around. We didn't do that. Do you want to proceed, Mr. Schneider, and I ask my questions, and if anybody has any follow-up after that, I can do that?
I'm fine.
Doesn't matter to me.
I just soon have you go ahead.
Okay. And if there's a burning question that a party has after that, I'll allow that.
I apologize if I overstepped. I thought that was...
I missed it myself, so... There's no set format for these things, so... Mr. Phillips, you had given some testimony about appellants. You don't have to get this out. Exhibit A1, Figure 1, which shows a barrier... I think it's a Jersey barrier in the buffer area. And then you contrasted that with your own design that you had helped inform in those images, and they did not show barriers in that. Are there such barriers called for by the EIS as a potential mitigation that could wind up in there, or...
Yes, they're listed as a potential to add in the EIS.
So they could be in the buffer, but they weren't depicted in the buffer by you? Or help me distinguish what your testimony was trying to get at with that.
AASHTO guidelines suggest that the buffer should be 5 feet from a street, and that if you're less than 5 feet, then a barrier should be considered. And so given the variable widths that we provided, if final design chooses to do a narrower, then potentially a barrier would be incorporated into the final design at certain locations.
If the buffer is less than 5 feet?
That's the standard in AASHTO.
Yeah, AASHTO. Okay. Thank you. You indicated that you looked at some of the driveways, but not all of them. And help me understand how you determined which of those were, which ones you would look at. If you said something along the lines of you looked at driveways that were critical to your understanding of impacts. That may not be a direct quote, but help me understand how you got to that point and evaluated which driveways to analyze.
Seven Bay Sand and Gravel has a very high volume of their concrete trucks, getting a terminology done right. And those vehicles need to be accommodated in our design, and that's a fairly unique situation. So we wanted to look at how those vehicles would operate when we're done with the project. So it's a uniqueness within this corridor that we said, yeah, I think we should look at that. Same thing with the Lowboy. It's a fairly unique vehicle and also warrants additional consideration. Understanding how auto turn works, historically, Sweat Path is done not with auto turn. That's newer technology, right? We weren't always designing using computer technology. Turning templates have been around in AASHTO books for decades, and they were repeatable from one condition to another to another. So you don't have to, at an initial stage, look at every one to understand a repeating issue from one driveway to another.
So I understand you didn't have to under the design standards, but I do want to make sure I understand the times when you elected to do so and what criteria you essentially used to get there. You indicated in your response to my question for Salmon Bay, for example, there was uniqueness about that situation, or the Lowboy presented uniqueness. was it uniqueness of a particular driveway, or was there any other criteria you used to say we should look at this driveway? And could you help me understand what other driveways you looked at? Salmon Bay is an example. Were there others that you did look at?
I believe the three in the EAS with Salmon Bay, the low boy at the marina, again, uniqueness because of that type of vehicle, mm-hmm. and 26th could be considered a driveway due to the businesses that are down 26th and how do they get these huge vehicles out of such a small street and what would that look like with the street, especially in consideration of the more significant street modifications we're doing on Market to narrow the number of lanes and ensure that that would still work.
Okay. You indicated that there's not much driveway design guidance available in the standards. It's sort of, it sounds like it's a developing area in your field is to provide design for those types of elements. In this case, I guess what I'm trying to get at, this may be based off a statement I think was Ms. Ellick said yesterday, is that in some sense these driveways are treated in the EIS more as intersections because of their unique nature. Is that how you viewed it? Did you apply design guidelines from, you said that there are design guidelines from intersections that you applied. How did you view driveways that way, or is that part of your consideration?
Yeah, I believe I said that in my testimony as well, especially the Salmon Bay, due to the volume in and out of that driveway complex.
Okay. And I want to understand, I did not understand this aspect of your testimony, and you indicated a design vehicle, an SU-30.
Yes.
And that you did use that. Did you not then, in your analysis, look at swept paths for, say, WB-40 or WB-67? How did that? That's how it sounded to me like when you said SU-30. That's what you relied on. Did you look at the other vehicles? If not, why not?
The auto turns included in the EIS show WB-50s at some mm-hmm. locations
okay.
and the SU in other locations.
Okay. So you used more than just the SU-30?
Yes.
Okay. You also mentioned that for some of these design elements, you might use more durable materials than paint, but paint's the only one I've heard identified. What might you use?
Thermoplastic is typical for pavement markings. Roadway markings like crosswalks is fairly typical. As you walk just downstairs out onto the street out here, you would see thermoplastic. The green that you'd see, say, down on 2nd Avenue is called MMA. I can't remember some scientific terminology mm-hmm. of what that stands for, but it's called MMA.
And is that always a surface that's applied to asphalt, or are there colored asphalts?
I believe it's an epoxy-based, and it attaches to either concrete or asphalt.
Okay, that was completely for my own interest, so... all right, no further questions. You had some questions, Mr. Schneider?
Yes. Going back to the Jersey barrier the hearing examiner asked you about, Mr. Bishop didn't testify that there was a Jersey barrier at that location, did he?
I'm not sure what location you're talking about.
The location you were talking about that is depicted in the sheet that you were testifying about that shows the Jersey. Didn't Mr. Bishop testify that he inserted one there precisely because the EIS talked about the possibility of using one that he didn't know where they would be and didn't know how they could be accommodated within the 5-foot buffer?
Mr. Examiner, I'm going to object. Mr. Schneider is simply restating his witness's testimony. I believe Mr. Phillips was looking at the depiction that shows a barrier and answering the question whether or not one is actually shown there in the design. I don't think he needs to restate his witness's testimony. It stands for itself.
Well, it's cross-examination, and I'm doing this because when Mr. Casilius asked the question, he asserted that Mr. Bishop had testified that there was a Jersey barrier in that location, which is definitely not what the testimony was. And again, this is cross-examination.
I'm going to allow the question, but we do need to let the Mr. Bishop's testimony speak for itself to some degree. If Mr. Phillips recalls it, I think he could certainly testify to that. But we'll limit it to that.
So have I fairly characterized Mr. Bishop's testimony about the Jersey barrier being illustrated there because he didn't know how it could be accommodated within a 5-foot buffer?
I think you're mixing two different things together from what I recall in his testimony.
Okay, what do you recall?
Put it in there because he didn't know where it was, so he just inserted it. He also talked about could it fit within a 5-foot buffer, and those are two different
I agree.
Discussions.
And I misspoke if I suggested anything other than the fact that he made both of those points, didn't he?
He made both of those points? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Yes, he made both of those points.
Okay. And he also talked about shy distances, and do you disagree with his testimony about shy distances?
He is correct. There are appropriate shy distances to use.
Okay. And have you read the hearing examiner's decision that led to the production of this environmental impact statement?
I haven't read every detail, but I understand portions of it, yes.
Okay. And wasn't one of her concerns about significant adverse environmental impacts the location of the barriers and the hazards that they themselves created?
Mr. Examiner, I'm going to object again on relevance. That was a decision about a DNS, not an EIS that's under review right now, related to an earlier design.
Yeah, we're talking about the issue of hazards and traffic impacts.
Barriers.
And, I'm sorry?
Barriers.
Barriers.
Right.
Which the testimony has been, both in this case and the last one, can constitute traffic hazards.
I'm going to overrule and allow you to continue along the questioning, as we've certainly discussed the barriers.
Okay, and if you don't remember the decision well enough to answer.
Questionable.
If you don't remember the decision well enough to respond to this, just say so. But isn't one of her concerns about the significant traffic hazards, the location of the barriers and the hazards they themselves created?
I think that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And are you finished?
I'm done, yes.
Were there any other questions?
No, you're right.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Mr. Casilius?
The department would like to call Ryan LaProuse.
Please state your name for the record and spell your last name.
Ryan LaProuse, LePROWSE.
And do you swear or affirm the testimony you provide in today's hearing will be the truth?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. LaProuse, can you please state your occupation?
I'm a senior transportation engineer for Parametrics.
Okay, and by whom are you currently employed?
Parametrics.
Okay. And can you briefly describe your education and training as it pertains to your profession?
Yes, I got a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering from University of Portland in 1999. I started out as an engineer in training for David Evans & Associates. I worked for them for 14 years, and then I've been with Parametrics the last 4 years. I got my professional license in both Washington and Oregon, registered PE.
And I'd like to ask you briefly to describe your prior experiences working on preparing EISs. Have you been involved in preparing an EIS other than this one?
Yes, over 10.
And in what capacity were you involved in those EISs?
I've typically been the lead transportation engineer or the lead author of the transportation discipline report or the parking discipline report. A few examples I can give of those would be the Alaska Way Promenade and Overlook Walk for SDOT, that I was the lead transportation discipline report author, as well as the parking discipline report author. As Ms. Ellig talked about, we first initially started out by creating the methods and assumption document, is where you start with the process and identify for all modes kind of what you're looking at that are relevant in the area. And then we then go into the existing conditions, then identify what impacts would be in the future for the no build, and then the build alternatives compared to that. So in a similar fashion, I did the parking discipline report for that project. So I came up with a methodology as the initial step, and then go through and identify impacts for the future conditions. Another EIS that I've worked on is the Columbia River Crossing EIS for WashDOT and ODOT. It was a 9-year EIS project. Ms. Hershey actually worked with me on it as well. She was on the freight team. I was the lead transportation author for the discipline report for that one. Parking was included in the discipline report. We also looked at non-motorized facilities, as there was a large trail component to that project that went across the bridge, as well as the connection points on both sides of the bridge, as well as through transit kind of station, LRT station facilities.
So you mentioned non-motorized transportation facilities. Have you been involved in others than the one you just mentioned or the one that we're talking about today?
Yes, all of the EISs have some non-motorized component. Not all of them have a trail component, but they have a non-motorized component that are included in those. So we'll look at forecasting non-motorized volumes and look at impacts for that mode and how it interacts with the other modes of transportation.
Okay. Can I hand you a copy of the resume? Thank you.
This will be R15.
Do you recognize this resume?
Yes, I do recognize this resume.
Does it accurately reflect your educational background, your professional training and experience?
Yes, this is the shortened resume showing a few of my EISs and other projects.
Add it as an, enter it as an exhibit.
No objection.
R15 is admitted.
Let's focus on this EIS that's the subject of this appeal. What was your role in the EIS?
I was the lead reviewer for the transportation discipline report and the parking discipline report for the DIS. I was involved in helping with the methodology as well as identifying impacts. So I was the lead reviewer for the DIS, and then in the FEIS, I became the lead author for the parking discipline report as one of our previous employees left the company, so I became the lead author for the parking discipline report.
Okay. As the lead reviewer of the transportation discipline report, I'm not going to ask you to repeat or restate what Ms. Ellig said, but I just want to ask, were you here for her testimony?
I was here for her testimony.
And do you agree with the methodologies that she described and the conclusions that are included in there?
Yes, I do agree.
And let's talk more generally about the methodology and approaches that are used in the transportation discipline report and the parking impact analysis as they compare to your other work in other EISs. Would you say that they are similar in approach?
Yes, they're similar in approach. I didn't mention, but so I've done EISs for lead agencies, including DOTs, Sound Transit, and Western Federal Lands as well. So.
I want to focus on the parking analysis specifically.
Okay.
So first, can you describe again what the deliverable was in the final EIS?
Yes, it was a parking discipline report. I think it's in volume 3 of the technical appendices. I think it's appendix C of that. It's a, I read a draft technical report and then a final technical report that are included.
I'm going to ask you a couple questions about those. So, Mr. Examiner, for the record, those are in R3. And we've been looking a lot at the transportation discipline report. The parking follows. References can be confusing. And again, for purposes of identifying the documents, the header includes the title of the report to make it easier to find.
So it says parking discipline over the top right corner.
R3 includes several technical discipline reports. It's the one that's closer to the back.
Right. I was just looking at the I've got the parking discipline report. I'm just looking at the Appendix C. It says daily driveway turning movements.
Yeah, no, sorry. This whole thing is the Appendix C, right?
So, yeah, we're going to...
It's a subset of Appendix C. Is the parking discipline?
No, that was what you were looking at. The Appendix C was the Appendix C to the transportation discipline report. The transportation discipline report ends with that, and the next page begins the parking discipline report, which is a separate technical.
Oh, I see. There's no cover page for it. Okay.
There should be.
Oh, this is, yeah. Okay. I'd meant these.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So first I want to ask you, how did you define the study area for your parking report?
So the study area is defined by the trip purpose that people are willing to, so after parking, how far are people willing to walk for trip purpose, kind of topography reasons, walking environment, as well as the available time that they have. So it's typically about an eighth of a mile to a quarter of a mile is kind of what we've used for this parking area. So it includes about roughly two blocks from the peripheral of all of the alternatives as shown. There's a figure within the document that shows kind of the study area if you'd like to see.
Could you direct us to that?
Yes, that is figure 3-1. It would be on page 3-3 of the parking discipline report. So after page 3-2, there's no page numbers, as Ms. Ellick mentioned on the figures, but it follows 3-2 and is before 3-4.
Okay. So is it correct to say the study area includes all of the alternatives?
Yes, it does include all the build alternatives. That is the way we have typically done parking discipline reports for all of the EISs. It's all inclusive of all the alternatives. So you can, when comparing to the no build, you can have a equal comparison across those when identifying impacts.
Okay. So were you present for Mr. Bishop's testimony about the scope of the study area?
I was.
And what's your recollection of his assessment of how you should have defined the study area?
I think my recollection was define it along each alternative, if I recall his. So the preferred alternative, he wanted the study area specific for the preferred alternative versus Ballard or Leary. Shilshal South is similar, but a specific study area for each of the alternatives.
So in your experience working on EISs, is that typical?
That would
use that approach to do a different study area for each of the alternatives?
That is not typical.
Why?
As I mentioned just a few seconds ago, you typically include all of the alternatives to identify the impacts when comparing the no build across all of the build alternatives in an equal fashion.
Okay. What does that allow you to do?
That way you can, when summarizing, you'll see later in the document when we're comparing overall loss of those alternatives, you can have an apples-to-apples comparison or an equal comparison of the impacts between the alternatives. So the set number, the no-bill number stays kind of the same.
Okay. Is the approach that you just described consistent with any studies or standards that you're aware of?
It is. It's supported by a document of kind of, and a few documents of how far people are willing to walk. There's a few documents that have been summarized that are used in the industry.
I'm going to ask you to turn to tab 33 of the city's binder, which is